a replica of a larger Buddha, which is 6 and a bit tall, 6 foot, which will be the Buddha, which is scheduled to be the Buddha for our new meditation hall. We get the Buddha first. That's the easy bit. It's very elegant, isn't it? It's very beautiful. It's the gun, it's the, what style, from India? Gupta style. And Gupta styles are very elegant. 10th century. There's a whole, it was offered by the Thai embassy in Ottawa and friends in Bangkok. And there are, if you ever want to make a Buddha, I got the place. There are factories, several, there must be, I don't know, I know of 4, on the outskirts of Bangkok that produce volumes and volumes of huge Buddhas. So it's a real industry there. And this one, it's called the Lost Wax Process. So what they do is the artist has a plaster, makes a plaster centerpiece, which is roughly the shape he wants to do it, the Buddha, and then he builds up the art with wax, okay? So then you have a red image made of wax. And then they put another coating of plaster around that wax. Then they flip this fellow upside down. They put in bleeding holes, and then they pour molten bronze in that space where the wax is, and then the bronze goes in, and the wax goes out, lost wax process, which you said started in India, didn't you? Maybe, what, 3,000 years ago?
Yes.
That's from his part of the world, just around the corner from Chennai, yeah? But this factory, the owner is a great disciple of our monastery, so he has a pavilion there where the pouring is a very inspiring and communal activity. Everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people came. So we had, I think 65 monks, many of them the abbots of our monasteries in Thailand, and 200-300 lay people. And sometimes the lay people get all inspired and they'll take a gold ring or something and chuck it into the first melting. They'll just take off some jewelry, or they offer some jewelry, say, here. And so the first crucible is usually semi-precious metal or precious metal, and that's poured in. So that would be in the head. But the top here is something that you can lift out on the big image and put relics in. And then they pour the rest in, and the monks are doing chanting, and it's really very, very inspiring. And so ancient yet so modern in some ways. So Thailand has a great love of icons. There's all the Buddhist countries do, except now Bangladesh, I suppose. It's harder there. But also, curiously enough, in that same factory, because I went there to look at it before we did the pouring, and I didn't like the ears and something else. So they called the artist over. Oh, you don't like the ears? How's that? Okay, that'll do. So you get a custom order, your Buddha. And we had all done this with emails. I was somewhere in the world, and just doing this with emails and pictures, and a friend was organizing it for me in Bangkok. Actually, the ambassador's wife, right? So that was fun. But in the same factory, they have a section where they do fiberglass effigies of arahants. of famous masters. So they're like Madame Tussauds kind of thing. And it's a bit spooky. Because you walk in, you say, oh, there's Lompa Man. I didn't see a Lompa Cha. I mean, there is a Lompa Cha in Wat Pa Pong, but there were several monks I knew. I knew of. And don't listen to him. I never, well, that's a horrible thought. But the, say that there were, there was one lab, it was like a lab, and there were four or three women in that lab, and they had the body cast had been done, and they were taking human, I think it was human hair, and one woman was taking human hair and putting it into a kind of a little tweezer receptacle. And she had a whole tray of little human hairs. And then another woman was taking, I forget what the third one was doing, she was taking it and gluing them in to little holes that had been drilled in the head and creating the hair, right? So it was real hair. And it really looked real. And then someone shaved it. So you had a bit of stubble. It's a really fascinating place. So this is kind of meaningful. We made quite a few of these. So what am I talking about? So if you get this this idea of awakening, I mean, that's obviously paramount to making right effort. And you can have, like say, my early attempts at enlightenment as a young monk were full of vitality, but lacking in intelligence. So they were quite, you know, this young guy gets to the monastery and driven to do this and do that, but they lacked maturity, intelligence, they lacked right understanding. So I was coming from a place of wanting to attain something, and hence what I wanted to attain wasn't certainly what I had, so I had to get rid of what I had in order to get rid, you know, this thing I wanted to attain, just a schlamazel, just a total mess. But that's where I was at, and that's where I had to start from. And so that's, you know, you start from where you're at. Just the way it is, and in the struggle to find peace, we all make mistakes. But the important thing is to just keep observing cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, rather than just like judging and criticizing yourself. That, I mean, there's a critical faculty functioning, but it's not from aversion; it's from seeing cause and effect. When I make this kind of effort, and that speaks to this question that. Which was a nice little question. When working with my hands on a craft, I've observed that they seem to know what to do without conscious thought that I'm aware of. Plus, the hands are happy. Any comment from your experience with wood? You know, have you ever just done anything deliberately to learn how to do it and watch the learning? I love doing that. I love taking up something new, not really knowing what I'm kind of getting into, reading about it, trying it, failing, and then all of a sudden I'm doing it. It's a really interesting, I find that really quite interesting. That's why I like to switch hobbies. So I say, well, like right now, Ajahn Pavro is with us, and he likes hand tools, and I like jigs and power tools. And I make a mess, and I make a lot of noise, and he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And so he's teaching me how to use the plane, and it's not so easy, actually. and, you know, to look at the grain of the wood and get it right. And so I haven't got it right yet, but I'm getting a feeling for it. And how did that come together? Well, it didn't come together by watching the YouTube. It was a start. You know, I looked at someone sharpening plane blades and so on, but I just do it. I just do it, and it doesn't work, and why doesn't it work? And I ask him, and you know, I try this, try that, and I try this, and I try that, and I keep trying, and all of a sudden, ooh, it's moving. And then I rip a big piece out, and I try and try, and then I look, and the mouth of it's too big, too small, blades this way, that way, what's the grain? And I keep looking, trying, looking, trying, looking, trying, and ooh, look at that. Oh, different kind of wood. All right, so cherry, that really goes nice, and then I hit hickory. Well, it's a mess, and that hickory all splinters on me, and then and that's the way it is, isn't it? You kind of, and that's intelligence to me. It's just you're intelligently looking at trying to do something, and seeing what works and what doesn't work. Right? There's no magic formula, but it does come together. It does come together in ways which are, I don't think you can really explain that. Like it's just because it's you're just learning through observation. So you got to keep trying. Right, but if you understand what you're trying to perhaps accomplish, so like when I'm planing a piece of wood, I want to get a smooth piece of wood. Why do I want to get it smooth? Because I realize that I can't get it that smooth with sandpaper. So sandpaper is actually quite coarse. I didn't realize until 2 weeks ago. I was all into sandpaper because it's, you know, I could just bash the whole thing with the sandpaper. But now, Pavaro comes along, and I like that. So I'd like to do that. I'd like to get it nice and smooth. So with your mind, what would you like to do? You know, do you want to make it rougher and splinter it and more jagged? Or would you like, you know, a bit smoother? Be nice, wouldn't it? Be a nice thing. And that's why we're here, because we have all touched levels, or we all experience levels of silence and stillness which we admire and aspire to, and then we have a lot of rough spots. So I think, you know, intuitively you kind of know where you're going. And where intelligence is going to work is if we get the first principles right. And what, to me, the first principle is knowing what's going on, knowing what kind of wood I'm using, or knowing the grain of the wood, or knowing how sharp the plane is. So that's what I've been kind of saying the first few days. Yeah, what's going on? Very simple. What's going on with you right now? Not with what you'd like it to be, but how is it? So that's the awakened mind. And if you keep doing that, then what you notice is that you start to be very aware of the moods of the mind. You know, like the drift of the mind. Maybe you're picking up a resentful memory and your mind's just moving into resentment all the time. Or maybe you're picking up some kind of exciting possibility of whatever, creativity or travel, and your mind begins to pick that up and run with that. And so the more you awaken to the way things are, the more you see the moods of the mind, and you see this whole sense of personhood being created through thought. That's the real thing which one has to sort of use as a diagnosis of what's going on, like the whole I-making, my-making. And that's simply a thought. The whole sense of a me doing something in the future is a thought. There is awareness, and there's awareness of like the sense of a person coming and going. That's really weird, don't you find? I find that really kind of like, I'm planning this big trip to New Zealand and Asia, and the mind starts to do the itinerary, and there's a me, a voice in there saying, and then I'll go there. And then I'll do that, and then I'll see Kusalo, and then and then it ends. And I notice, well, there's no person there. There's awareness, but that whole sense of a me, it ends with a thought. And that, it doesn't end in nothingness, because there is consciousness. And then there's this silence, right? A breath. You know? And then I'll do this, and then I'll do that. And then we'll go there, na 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 na. And then, no, oh. And there's silence again. So it seems to me one of the things that I want to train myself is to see the silent, the gaps, the spaces. They're kind of more interesting to me than my personality. It doesn't interest me so much. I don't know, maybe you're really interested in your personality, but me, I have 70 years of it, fine. Whatever. Whereas the silence, that's much more interesting. So when I think of planing wood, and I think of meditating, I think what's really smooth is silence, isn't it? You know, oh. So then I have a kind of benchmark, yeah? Benchmark which I can reflect off of, like, okay, where's the silence here? And as I notice that, then I also notice the creation, the stories and all of that. And I'm not rejecting the stories, I just know they're really just conditioned phenomena coming into the mind. Because, like, if I've been writing emails to Ajahn Kusalo, and I've been writing emails to Thailand, and I have some retreats, then what's going to come up? Our stories of Ajahn Kusalo, and yes, what else could come up? You know, my trips to Mars. I mean, it can only be that. So it's a very logical. But we get preoccupied with them through self-thinking. Now, if they're really loaded with, like, some kind of negative energy, like I've been betrayed, or something fabulously positive, then that energy that they're loaded with really drives them very, very strongly, doesn't it? So we've all seen that where someone hurts us in some way, and the memory comes up, and then, whoa, and the storyline's very, very strong. But you can see, oh, that's memory. And then that you could see that storyline is very charged. Oh, wow, that's really charged. He's not denying that. You can't deny that. But you go, oh, what's that charging feeling like then? Right? So you get behind the storyline, but you're not denying its existence. You just feel it's like a lot of energy there. And you get behind it all the time. You get behind it. And more you intuit the silence and the space within the movement. But you can't deny the movement. You still have to kind of somehow deal with it. Sometimes it's not charging, just shift your attention. You know, like you're eating your fruit. Did everyone enjoy their fruit salad today? you're eating your fruit salad, and you know, your mind is just doing something trivial. Well, no, I think I'll do pineapple. And you do pineapple, and you hold your attention on pineapple. Why? Not that you're obsessed with pineapple, something like that, but you're using just the gravity of taste, maybe, as a way of grounding yourself, and ooh, and then you come back to the silence just through taste. And that's quite fun, actually. But though, because a lot of things aren't charged, right? A lot of things are just habit. It's blah, 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 blah. And, you know, just this, that's just the habit of mind. So we want to train ourselves, I think, to move away from those deep habitual patterns, which aren't bad, they're just trivial, but to try to get more clarity, more brightness, and for me, to more just notice the space and silence of the mind. And then from that, I mean, it's very rewarding in itself. Because it's rewarding, then the craving falls away. The need for compensations, distractions, and so on falls away, because you've really tasted something which is desirelessness, you know, which is deeper than the trivial pursuits we usually get caught up into. But it's a training. It's a training rather than a punishment. Your meditation is not a punishment, by the way. It is a training, and so this ability to shift attention, we can do that from one object to another. But sometimes if the charge in the memory or whatever is very, very strong, then you really can't shift away from it. You just have to be with it, don't you? You just have to bear witness to something maybe quite difficult. But it's the same practice. It takes a lot of forbearance and, I suppose, a kind of an intelligent faith that this too will change. That's why we keep popping that idea in. This will change. This is changing. Now, if you can take that idea as a perception that you use, and this is one of the brilliant things of Buddhism, it, it really doesn't demand a doctrinal belief system. We have doctrines like any outfit, but it doesn't really demand that. But what it asks of us is to use perceptions, which are skillful, and interpret or notice life through particular sets of perceptions. And if you do those, they bring the heart to peace. So if I can notice, I can be very upset about something, and I can say, oh, first of all, this is a mood. Upset is this way. And what's the changing nature of this mood? I have to really step back and notice it to be able to do that perception. If I'm lost in it, I can't do that. So that gives me space. What's the changing nature of this? And then it is changing. It's got vitality and it wants to think and so on. But my mind comes more to witnessing consciousness. So that's using perception as opposed to a Buddhist philosophical position that everything changes. Is that true? Everything changes? True or not? Yeah? What about Nibbana? Huh? Trick question. Huh? It's not true. It's not what the Buddha taught. Not true. Trick question. He taught that has a nature to rise as a nature to cease. But there is the unchanging. There's no self. Now you're more cautious. Buddhism, true or not? There's no self. Now no one's answering. Not true. I didn't teach that. Taught that which is a nature to rise is a nature to cease, and there's no essence in it. There's no self-essence in it. Didn't teach no self. Huh? Now, that's why is that different? Because if you teach there is no self, then yeah, but wait a minute. There's something going on here. So no self sounds very nihilistic, kind of annihilationism. So he taught that there is the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless, and that there are the five khandhas, the conditionality, that which arises and ceases, arises and ceases, arises and ceases. And if you focus on that which arises and ceases, that's what you get. You'll get change. Fine. Right? You eat your breakfast, it changes. And you have a full stomach, you have to go to the toilet. This is the nature. So that's half of your life. Hopefully it's not your whole life. Breakfast and dinner. And then the spiritual part is there's the unconditioned. So then you apply this perception of change. Ah, okay, now there's this witnessing, there's knowing, whatever way we want to talk about it, and you begin interested in that. Now you could say, I am witnessing. Yeah, you could say that. And then you say, I am witnessing. But then it's silent again. So is there witnessing and this kind of little thing, extra thing called I, witnessing? Or is there witnessing? Okay, say, you can say, I am awareness. I am awareness. So there's an I, a little bit, and there's awareness, me doing the awareness. Doesn't compute, does it? But there is awareness. Or, I'm so excited to go to New Zealand. Now there's excitement, yeah, but there's an extra little bit called I am excited, or is there just excitement? No, you check it out. So if you find something, tell me, leave me a note. But I don't know, I've been looking for a while. Who's been looking? Now, that inquiry isn't just like being clever and being tricky, but it's actually an inquiry which brings you to silence, because there is no essential like little critter that has the anger, but there is anger. And that is arising and ceasing in awareness, arising and ceasing in awareness. So rather than a little critter having the anger, what Buddhism uses, Theravada Buddhism uses dependent origination. It says, with this as condition, there's that. This being that comes to being. this not being, that isn't there. Without this, there's not that. And so you can see that the stream of consciousness is conditionally formatted, dependent origination. And we live in that world, and so what we do is we do our utmost to make the cause and conditions for well-being of ourselves and others. It's called morality, generosity, and salt on your eggs, whatever. But then there's a larger picture, and that's consciousness itself, awareness, and that you cannot find as an object. Can awareness be described? Does it have any qualities? No. Awareness knows. Can you see your eyeballs? That's the sort of analogy. Can awareness know awareness? Can awareness, what's the taste of awareness? Is it salty? How big is awareness? Well, 2 foot? Where is awareness? Up in my bedroom. I think I lost it today. Is it male or female? I can know that, like awareness, I don't know femininity in terms of my biology because it's male biology, but I cannot say that awareness is male. That doesn't compute. Awareness knows maleness, say. Is it Canadian? There you go. No. Is it Indian? No. Is it old? Is it young? Is it big? No. It has no qualities. So it's ineffable. So that's why the only thing you can do is be aware. And as soon as you try to find that, you're lost. You've just stepped outside of the program. And that's why the focus on desire is so important. Desire has its importance, and it's important to put a coat on if you're cold or you have a sliver in your hand, you take out the sliver. And that's in the realm of dependent origination. But in the realization that the Buddha had, looking for something would be a trap. Because anything is an object. And how can you look for awareness? You can only be aware. Yeah? I'm not playing with words, it's just it's very subtle that. So you more and more you see that, I do good works, I help, but I'm also interested in the silence, in the knowing itself. And you learn how to just hold attention with knowing, irrespective of the object. And that's where you get ideas like of equanimity. And someone insults you, someone praises you, right? You see how praise, and insult, and you begin to work with that. Someone says you're great, and you see the movement. And then someone says you're a turkey, you see the movement. Or was it a goose? I can't remember. And you see, what's not moving? Rather than think, I should just be able to take all insults really equanimously. I'm a Buddhist monk, and everyone should be able to just rubbish me, and then I'll just... But no, you feel that moves. So 20 years after my first experience in Toronto, I want to upgrade the Toronto population now. I was staying with my mother. My dad had died. And the Dalai Lama was, His Holiness the Dalai Lama was teaching a Kala Chakra initiation in CNE. And my mom lived at Blur and Jane. So I walked down the lakeshore, and then I'd walk up along lakeshore to CNE. And I attended the first 3 days of that Kala Chakra initiation because it was on the Four Noble Truths. It was great. Thousands of people. My hometown. So then I'm coming back. The last story was with the kind of more abusive treatment we got. Now, as I was walking on Lakeshore, people would honk, and I kind of... And I got the thumbs up. I thought, I like that better. So obviously I like praise, and I like the thumbs up, and I don't like the egg thrown at me or whatever. But in awareness, it all belongs, right? And I'm never going to approve of, hatred, But yeah, it's part of life. So you hang out with good friends, right? You hang out with good friends and so on. And then go 20 years forward from that, and we just had an ordination in Perth. So Ontario's really moving. Really shifting the consciousness.
Now we've got Doug Ford.
Yes. Doug Ford. He's for our equanimity, is he? Oh, that's an interesting one. Political buttons, right? Donald. Yeah, politics. Okay, shall we do some meditation? Stretch your...